This week, the softer side of math and its impact on your health care.
My mother should be able to tell them how aggressive the tumor is and also predict how fast it's going to grow.
Plus, more thoughts on moms. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. The treatments for cancer have been changing drastically in the past few years. There are predictions that cancer will become a controllable condition within our lifetimes. And one way researchers are making strides against cancer is by using math. It's a field that used to be considered separate from the biological sciences. But Dr. Amina Ladetti, assistant professor of mathematics at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, is just one example of the way those disciplines are now beginning to talk to each other. She uses math to map the growth of cancer. She developed a mathematical model that shows where and how quickly a tumor can grow, and that helps doctors decide how best to treat that particular tumor.
Math is not only theory and abstracts and formula and theorems and proofs. There is another aspect of math that tends to be less known, and that's the applied math or applications. We take math concepts and we apply them to any field. And one of the fields, actually two of them, that really are making use and taking advantage of the flexibility of math is biological sciences and medical sciences. If we take, for example, cancer, and we try to define the basic definition of cancer, which is defined as the outcome of uncontrolled cell division due to mutations in a person's DNA. So even within these statements, you can see that there are some keywords that indicate that there is math in there. There is uncontrolled, which means something is growing and growing unbounded without bounds, and there is the cell division. Already there is a keyword in there, division, which means we're dealing with something that divides. One of the clues that we oncologists or oncologist researchers, they look for is the rate of cancer cell proliferation. Again, if you look at this sentence, the rate of cancer cell proliferation, rate, okay? So the rate is a very, by itself, is a mathematical word in there. So we know, or research knows, that higher rates are key components of aggressive cancer types. So recognizing that there are limitations in the lab, so if we go back to the lab, is very time-consuming. It requires a lot of money to run, a lot of staffs, and so on. Math comes in very helpful because I could design a mathematical model that describes rate proliferation and keep tracks of the dynamics of these rates, and I can build a computer simulation, and I can plug in any number, any scenario I want in my computer, and it's going to give me a prediction, all right? And it is a loop around that. So, and these predictions help in designing the experiments building a mathematical model and running simulations tends to be much cheaper than running a lab. When I run a simulation, I can tell you, I can put as many scenarios as I want, and I can sit down with the biologist or with the bioscience researchers or even with the oncologist or the medical doctor and be able to give him a couple of scenarios based on the information I get from the rate and so on. Whereas running a lab, it's time-consuming and money.
And is this something that you have actually done, and what kind of cancers is it used for?
The cancer I worked on was the HER2-positive cancer, HER2-positive, and it's another type of cancer. And I built a mathematical model. The question was, if we know the number of genes can we predict the rates of growth of that tumor? So you see that there is a correlation between the two. We want to know if that cancer or how fast that tumor is growing. If we know the number of receptors, okay, from a patient's biopsy, and that's readily available and it's doable, and the number is a count, they would tell us, oh, okay, this patient has, for example, 20 million or 2 million or 3 million receptors, okay? So I will put that number in my model, my simulation, and I should be able, my model should be able to tell them how aggressive the tumor is and also predict how fast it's going to grow. And doctors need to know this information because based on this information, they devise a chemotherapy protocol. So they go hand in hand. The objective is to be able to make a prediction, you know, and you want to make a prediction away from the patient. You don't want to give the patient the chemotherapy or the medication and then see how the patient will react. So.
And you're basically talking about something that is logical and rational and predictable, as long as you understand the mathematical formula. Is that pretty much the case with medical applications of math, or are there things that are simply chaotic and math doesn't deal with?
In the metastasis case, like stage number four, stage number three and four are very hard to deal with, even medically.
Once it starts to spread, there's too many variables.
That's the point. There are too many variables, and putting a mathematical model on these too many variables is just not going to solve the real problem. It can give you a hint. It can give you some prediction on the way you would administer the medication or to help in drug design and development down in the future. Pharmaceutical companies are using mathematics and systems biology to design the drugs for advanced cancer cases.
All right, and if I could, I'd love to find out what led you to this field.
Oh, that's a very good question, and I'm happy you asked. I was a math major all the time. Since I grew up, I loved math. I had no problem with that. But I also wanted to be a medical doctor. So, and I grew up in Morocco, which is a kind of a little bit different. You can't do both. Either you go to a medical field or to math. And I was good in math, and kind of I didn't have a choice. My teachers, the school, the whole system was pushing me toward, you're good in math, you're going to go do a math major, and whoever does a math major, they go to engineering. So that's the path I followed when I was in Morocco. I got my high school diploma in mathematical sciences. So we kind of major early. It's not the same. It's not the same as here in the U.S. And then I went down for 1 year in engineering. I got a prestigious scholarship to go do engineering. I didn't like it much. It was not me. So, and then I went back to the university, and I majored in math and theoretical physics. I did 2 years in Morocco, and I got married, and we came here to the U.S. My husband got a Fulbright scholarship to come to RPI. To do his PhD in electrical engineer. And I went back to school. I changed my major. I went to computer science. And now it was like in the 90s, early 90s. That's the hot topic. Everybody's majoring in computer science. So I did my undergrad in computer science. And then I went to RPI. I got a teaching assistantship in to do my PhD in math. So when I went to RPI, for me, math was just theory up to 2000, up to 1999, 2000. When I went to RPI to go to PhD in math, I was thinking about theory, abstract, theorems, and so on. And when I talked to my advisor, he said, I told him, do I have to write theorems and prove an abstract? He said, no. You can pick an application and apply all your knowledge in physics, computer science, and math to it. And he left it open to me. He said, go out, compass is large, go and see what you like to do and come back and tell me where you want to apply your math. There was a course that my advisor was given, and that's Mathematical Modeling for Biology and Medicine. That was the title. It was in spring 2000. I don't know, but it's still fresh in my mind. I took that course, and I just fell in love with the applications in biology and medicine. That was the first time in my whole career I'm going to see math applied to biology and medicine. And then we started talking about cancer. Since it's personal, my grandma died from cervical cancer, my father from lung cancer. So it was really very close to me, and I wanted to learn more. I taught myself biology, and I went to a lot of trainings. One important aspect for my training was National Science Foundation, NSF. At that time when I started mathematical biology, it was around 2000, 2001, when the sequencing of the DNA and the genome just came about, and a lot of trainings and opportunities were open. And I took advantage of every single workshop, every conference that is sponsored by National Science Foundation. And the difficulty is building bridges between math and the other sciences. This bridge, we really have to be trained very well to be able to communicate between these two extreme disciplines. You know, when you think about math and medicine, each one of them sits in its own corner and they don't communicate. And I think National Science Foundation did an extremely very good job to train a lot of applied mathematicians, applied computer scientists, applied physicists who were interested in the medical field. And they created that bridge between math, computer science, and the medical sciences. People, they think about mathematics as a hard subject, an abstract, and a dry subject. And that's not the case. And I think because the community is not aware of what I usually call the softer science of mathematics. And one of the best ways to engage students in math is to relate math to something they're already interested in. For example, I was interested in cancer just because it was a personal issue to me, breast cancer, cervical cancer, lung cancer, and so on. And I was just curious, how can I use my skills I learned to contribute to the cure against cancer? So it's something that I had something that motivated me. And even better way is to get students to make that connection. And I think that's what's really missing. And that's why math is sitting by itself somewhere, and the other sciences, the same thing, and the connection is not there. And just as I said, if the bridge is trying to build that bridge between math and the other sciences, and once we train faculty, employers, all the stakeholders to really walk, to build the bridge. They can't walk with if there is none, but if we all come together as a community and build that bridge between math and the other sciences, I think the perception about math will eventually change, and people will be able to see the softer side of math.
Dr. Amina Ladetti is Assistant Professor of Mathematics at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York. For more information on her work, check out her commentary for the Academic Minute on our website, wamc.org. Coming up, Acquired Mothers and Stories We Tell Our Mothers. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% Archives at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1295. Any show that celebrates women certainly has to make a big deal about mothers. And so I hope you'll forgive me if we continue the mom theme from last week's show. This next report from Ann Noy Sani will be part of the first episode of a new podcast called Mother that she's launching with another independent radio producer, Amy Gastelum, on Mother's Day. Sani's report is about another type of maternal bond, the bond with your spouse's mother.
In India, there's a whole genre of soap operas where the central tension is not between lovers, but rather between mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law vying for household power. My mother-in-law and I never had that kind of drama. We like each other, but we don't always know what to say to each other.
My name is Rama Sani. I live in Montreal, Canada.
And how are we related?
To you?
Yes.
You are my daughter-in-law, my son's wife. In Hindi, we call daughter-in-law Bahu. You are my Bahu.
We've taken such different paths in life. She grew up in North India in the early years after independence from the British. I'm from Wyoming and South Dakota. The only Indians there prefer to be called Native Americans. When we first met almost a decade ago, I didn't understand any Hindi, and my mother-in-law struggled to really express herself in English. So we cooked, filling the silences with talk of spices or recipes.
Perfectly okay. No water. Water is all right. Anything I make, you used to ask me, Mommy, how you make it? Can I have the recipe? I was really happy that being an American, you cook so nice Indian food.
At 19, her marriage was arranged and she moved to Canada with her new husband. By 30, my mother-in-law had 3 children. She was probably expecting a daughter-in-law who spoke Punjabi or knew Indian culture.
You can also taste.
I went to college, then grad school. I'm 33 now, and I still don't know how to change a diaper.
How you do it here?
Let me just show you how I do it.
Yeah, I was surprised in the beginning when you asked me, Mommy, I want to learn this, I want to learn this. I said, oh my gosh, she's really interested in cooking. Even my younger daughter, she was not interested before marriage. So she never learned anything from me. You can put as many as you want. They give nice taste.
In those early years, before I started Hindi lessons, and she learned not to try to take me shopping or to ask about grandchildren, it felt like we might never understand each other. But we kept cooking together.
You want to put some rose water or something?
I want to make it the way you make it.
I don't put. I put some choti elachi.
Okay, that's nice.
You have that?
Hanji.
Elachi?
Hanji.
Oh, we can...
You mean hari elachi?
Hari elachi.
Hanji. Upar hai.
So in America, everybody is an American. We'll try our best to give them our sanskar. How can I explain you? Sanskar means... our customs. We cannot control, we can just teach our children our customs. So slowly and slowly, it will be different thing.
Thank you.
Oh, achha, like this.
Two women in the kitchen. So typical, right?
Good.
But how many white chicks from South Dakota know that the secret to good carrot halva is waiting until the very end to add the ground cardamom, the elaichi, as we say in Hindi? And how often do you find an Indian mother grooming a young American to carry on her recipes?
That's really nice. It's not overly sweet.
Yeah.
Came out okay?
Yeah. It came out okay.
NPR's food blog will run a related essay by Ann Noy Sani, which will include one of her mother-in-law's recipes. Look for NPR's food blog, The Salt. Mothers create the connections that let us understand our past, But what if you can't let your mother know who you truly are now? This essay is from a young man who loves his mother, but knows that the son his mother loves is not who he is.
My name is Lee, and I'm from Texas. No one loves me more than my mother. You see, it's a complicated story, but I have a single mother. I, of course, have a father. Everyone does. But with time passing, he's gradually removed himself from my life. I have other family as well. Aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents. But my family has a healthy amount of drama, like most, and my mother and I decide to keep more to ourselves. I always say that it's never been an obligation to love your family. You don't get to choose them. But I love my mother. She has devoted her entire life to me. She calls me Mi Rey. It means my king in Spanish. I remember one time when I was like 11, I got home and I just started crying because I had been made fun of in school that day. Believe it or not, elementary school children can actually be some of the most awful people. I was so sad all afternoon, thinking I wasn't good enough and that no one wanted me and that's why I had no friends. I was just some nerd who could do your schoolwork. After she got back from her second job, she came and saw that I was upset and just held me. We sat and we talked for ages. She explained how other people's opinions didn't matter because she knew how amazing I was and all that mattered was that I knew. She would tell me how great I was and that she worked so hard so that I could have a better life than hers. And that I had to work hard too because all she wanted to see was that I was happy. Without her, my life would be nowhere near as beautiful. And I work hard in part because later, I want to be able to give her a better life too. Not that our relationship is perfect. We fight, we disagree. But not enough to prevent me from loving her. The problem is, though, my mother knows almost nothing about me. It's not just the gay atheist thing. It's that everything about me, how I behave, what I believe, how I speak, dress, and think, is unknown to my mother. I've tried to show her who I am, hint at ideas, open up a bit, but it doesn't go well. "I don't know why you are that way," she says, "because I didn't raise you to be like that." Imagine if I showed her how I was as a whole. That's why I have to be different with her. But it's hard to change who you are and how you act. The result is just some sad little boy, like I'm depressed or something. I speak less, and when I do, the happiness isn't there. I don't make gestures or move around very much, and I sigh every time I remember how I have to change or censor what I'm about to say, which ends up being a lot. It's not like I'm trapped. I have my friends. With them, I get to be exactly who I am, and they still choose to be a part of my life. I'm not afraid. With my mother, it's like there's this giant wall separating us, often leaving our relationship tense and cold. I feel like the person she loves and supports, the person that she's devoted her life to, is imaginary. And if she knew who I was, she wouldn't feel the same. And that hurts me. I want her to actually see the person she raised, and still love me, and still have her in my life. But now isn't the moment for that, and I understand. We aren't ready for that, and I can wait. While I may seem unhappy when I'm with her, what would truly make me unhappy is for her to be unhappy with who I am. And in the meantime, I'm not going to love my mother any less. My name is Lee, and I'm from Texas.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. This week's show is number 1295. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.